speaker tonight comes from Philadelphia, group Rittenhouse Step, and please help me welcome Cooper.
Hi everyone, my name is Cooper, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Cooper!
Working like that? Is that good?
Yeah.
Okay. Got a little nervous right before I got up here, it never fails. I was like, oh yeah, I'm fine, I'm great, I'm fine. And I was like, oh, oh, oh. So I ran behind the pine tree, I said a little prayer. So. My home group is Rittenhouse Step Group. We meet on Friday nights, 8:15, 19th and Walnut, in the church, basement of the church there. So if you ever want to come out and check it out. It's a small group, but I recently changed home groups, and I like it there. So my sobriety date is October 24th, 2005. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and you know the deal, and I get to sponsor some people too, and it's cool. So I'm just gonna tell you what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. As a direct result of experiencing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and continuing to, you know, practice those principles to the best of my ability on a daily basis. And I was born in Texas. I was raised there. I lived there probably for the first 24 or 25 years of my life, and people noticed pretty quick that I don't really have an accent. And I remember getting this idea when I was around 12 that it made me sound stupid and it made me sound like a hick. So I learned to talk a different way so that you wouldn't think I was a hick, which is kind of funny because I was surrounded by hicks. I was in Texas. It's not like anybody was saying, oh, well, you sound like a hick. We all sounded the same, but somehow I just remember getting this idea. My mom remarried when I was 12, and my stepfather is from Connecticut, and I guess I decided I would sound more intelligent if I sounded like him. So I've moved a lot of different places, and everywhere I've moved or visited, I've picked up a little piece of that accent. And I mean, it's classic alcoholic, you know, just doing whatever I have to do to fit in wherever I am and make you like me, you know. And I've been doing that from as early as I can remember. Oops, there went a pen. And, oh, by the way, I love this meeting. I love that it's outside and the dogs. I didn't know there were going to be lots of dogs, and I love dogs. That's really exciting. I'm glad you guys brought your dogs. And, you know, I come from a pretty normal family. I'm my mom, my dad, I have an older sister. But from early on, just like you've heard this a million times before, I didn't feel like it fit into my family. And it wasn't anything they were doing to me. They weren't going out of their way to make me feel uncomfortable. My mom's, like, awesome. I have a great mom and a great family. And my mom's one of those moms that would just go out of her way and do anything for me. And she's still like that. And somehow I decided that I just didn't fit in there. And, you know, that I was weird. And I was some kind of outsider or whatever. And I wasn't telling anyone that I felt like that either. I just remember being like, something's wrong with me and something's different about me, and I can't tell them because if they know how I feel, they won't like me. And that was terrifying for me, really early on, people not liking me and people not accepting me and approving of me. And before I even picked up a drink, I remember being addicted to that love and attention and approval, and there was never enough of it for me. And even my mom, like, remarked on how I was when I was a little kid. It's just like she would just give and give and give, and I would just want more and more and more. And, you know, that it was, like, after I was able to make amends with her and we could talk kind of honestly, she let me know how frustrating that was for her as a mother, because she went out of her way to love me and give me everything that she had, and it was just never enough for me. And I just remember feeling that way all the time. And I was a real, you know, anxious kid and real sensitive, and, you know, people laughed. I assumed they were laughing at me. If someone was telling a joke in a room and everyone laughed at it, I thought they were laughing at me. And it was just self-centered to the extreme. And, you know, I was in my head a lot. I like to pretend. Like, toys were, you know, I didn't really care about toys that much. I like to pretend, like, go off by myself and pretend to be anyone other than who I was and to be anywhere other than where I was. And, you know, I just remember thinking from really early on that, you know, I just would be willing to do whatever you wanted me to do, just so you would love me and, like, approve of me. And so I set about doing that, and I remember feeling, like, real, you know, just real lonely and, like, cut off from everybody. But then on the outside, I would be real funny and, like, laugh and go out of my way to make you laugh and make you happy and feel comfortable. Because I figured if everyone was, you know, laughing because I made them laugh, then they couldn't laugh at me for being who I was. You know, I wasn't consciously thinking those things, but looking back, that's exactly how I felt. And I guess, you know, just a couple things about me that don't make me an alcoholic, but there were things that I dealt with from early on that I didn't know how to deal with these things, and it just worsened the condition for me. It just made it more difficult for me, because I was always trying to figure out, like, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, and looking around and trying to figure it out. And something that, you know, has been a part of my story and still is a part of my story is that I've struggled with gender my entire life. Like, I have never known whether I was a boy or a girl. And nobody around me seemed to know either. Like, people would always be asking me, are you a boy or a girl? Or asking my mom, is that a boy or a girl? And I remember being like, oh, every time someone would ask, I'd just clench inside because I didn't really know either. And plus, I was like, why do you care? Why does it matter, you know? And I just remember that being, like, really difficult for me because I just didn't really, I don't know. Today it's different because I know that it's okay whatever I am. It really doesn't matter whether I'm a boy or a girl. I still don't know what I am, but I don't need you to, like, make it okay for me. Now I'm okay with it because I figure, you know, my higher power made me this way. This is how I was born into the world, and there's really nothing I can do about it other than accept it. And that's one of the gifts of AA for me, is that I can accept who I am today, whatever that is, even if I don't even know what that is. I can accept that about myself. It's really cool, because I really struggled with that a lot. And, you know, it's one of those things I thought would never go away, and I would never be able to be okay with it. And I'm okay with it, so that's really cool. Another thing is I was a bedwetter. So, and I wet the bed for a long time, like until I was 17, I wet the bed. And as a result of that, I didn't feel like I could let anyone know who I was, because if they found out that that was the truth, they wouldn't want to be anywhere near me. So I just spent a lot of time just kind of holding everyone over here and not telling anyone anything that was going on. I had a lot of shame about it, and I just didn't want you to find out, because I was sure nobody would want to be my friend. And, you know, that doesn't make me an alcoholic. For a long time, I thought it did. I thought, oh, well, I went to bed, and I could never, oh, and it made me, you know, and all kinds of stuff. I try to look for some reason why I felt the way I felt. And now I know it's because I'm an alcoholic. And that's why I feel, you know, why I felt the way I did when I did, and why I can feel that way on any given day. It's my alcoholism. And I'm just really grateful to have a name for it and not be walking around in the dark wondering what's wrong with me. Because there's a solution for alcoholism, and, you know, I can apply that solution to the problem, and it works every time. So that's pretty cool. So another thing that doesn't make me an alcoholic, but something that was really hard for me to deal with, when I was 9, my parents split up. They were divorced, and I was really the only kid in my little town in Texas. I grew up in a little suburban town in Texas that had divorced parents. There's, like, maybe one other set of kids that did, and I remember, like, it just shattered me. It really, like, screwed me up, because I don't know, I felt like the end of the world was coming. I thought I was the only one it was happening to. You know, looking back, like, everybody else was going through it, too, but I couldn't see any of that. I just saw that I was suffering and I was in pain, and I remember, like, I shut down and I just became very angry, and that kind of set the ball rolling even more for me. As a matter of fact, again, when I made amends with my mom, a little bit after that, we were walking around having a talk, and I used to not be able to have any kind of talk with my mom because I was too defensive, and she'd try to say something, and I'd cut her off, and, you know, but now we can talk like real people, and we have a real relationship. It's really awesome, and, you know, she was saying to me, you're back. Like, I feel like I haven't, you know, really, you haven't been here since you were 9. You know, that you just left the building. And so that's really neat that, you know, A has given me back. I don't know. I don't even know if it's given it to me back. I don't think I ever had a sense of self or, like, comfort with myself at all. So it's just given me that. And that's really neat. So anyway, I also, this bears mentioning, I have an older sister, and I would, like, this is how my mind works. My sister would play this game with me called I'll Be Your Best Friend If. And it would be like, whatever thing she dreamt up, she'd be my best friend if I did it. And I would do it every time. And I never got it, that she wasn't going to be my best friend. She was just baiting me into whatever she wanted me to do. And I would get mad every time because I'd really think, this time I'm going to do the magic thing and she's going to be nice to me and be my best friend. And that never happened like that. And I remember my mom being like, why don't you just, like, hit her? Like, beat her up one good time, she'll leave you alone. Be like, I can't do that, you know. And I played that game until I was, like, 16. And then finally the rage that built up from me thinking it would be different every single time and it not being different, I beat her up really bad and she never touched me again, you know. You know, it's just funny. I mean, I could have probably done that a long time ago and just gotten it out of the way, but, I just thought, maybe. And that's how I've lived my life. It's like, it'll be different this time. I know if I just do it this way, maybe if I try it that way, maybe if I go around this way, you know, and it never works. The things I come up with never work. And, so, just a little overall sketch of my thinking, you know, I would just do these things, I call them blackouts, but it was before I picked up a drink, and it would be like I'd come up with some stupid plan, and I wouldn't even know I came up with the stupid plan until I was in the middle of doing it, and it wasn't working, and then I'd be like, how did I get here, what's happening to me? Things like, you know, just, I don't know, like, setting the couch on fire, you know, just stuff like trying to make a candle in the house. It's like, oh, I'll make a candle, you know, and I burn a hole in the couch, and, you know, it's just stuff like that. I'd be like, why is the couch on fire? You know, it's like, well, you know, why didn't you think of that before you made the candle? Anyway, and so by the time I picked up a drink, and I hear people say this, and I totally relate to it, I really needed a drink, because I was feeling very separate from everybody, and really not okay with myself, and really afraid of what you thought of me all the time, and it was just constantly hounding me. And I was also really afraid that God didn't want anything to do with me, because I grew up in the Bible Belt, and I had really religious grandparents who, they were trying to, like, pass on some kind of spiritual principles, and they happened to be fundamentalist Christians, and I happened to already just sort of be terrified of any kind of God that I couldn't see. And as they were trying to just pass this on to me, I just got more and more scared and freaked out about it. And I remember, like, staying up at night afraid to go to sleep because I would do something in my sleep that would banish me to hell for the rest of my life. And I just would just lay there sweating and not wanting to go to bed. And just convinced that, like, God worked for everybody else but me. And I never told anybody that, because I didn't want them to think I was a sinner or a bad person, or I don't know what I didn't want them to think, but I wasn't going to tell anyone that that's what was going on. So, you know, and I would just pray to God to just, like, don't let me go to hell. You know, I just spent a lot of time doing that. I remember that, and it was added more awfulness to what was already going on. So I picked up a drink at 12, the first one that I remember. And I remember it, you know, it was at a party after my parents' divorce, and my Uncle Spanky was there, and I wanted to be Uncle Spanky. I wanted to be all the men in my family, and but Uncle Spanky was like the king of all the men in my family in my eyes, because he had a motorcycle and a waterbed, and he got all the chicks, and, like, I thought he was awesome, you know, and I wanted to be just like him. And I remember that night, you know, it was just like probably just a little joke among the adults, like, oh, you want a drink of this, kid, you know, and I, you know, took a drink of whiskey, and I drank a lot of whiskey, I guess, for a kid, and I remember everyone laughing, and, you know, I almost was like, I know it didn't happen like this, but I almost remember people cheering and clapping and, like, going nuts and be like, yeah, all right, yeah, you won that. I don't think that's what happened, but I remember feeling like I was finally, like, here I am, and I can be like one of you guys, and it felt right to me. And I know I didn't start drinking then, like, I wasn't, you know, getting wasted at 12, but later on, when it became available to me and I was able to do whatever I needed to do to get it, probably around 16 or 17, I picked up alcohol, and I picked it up with a vengeance, and I just started drinking whatever I could and getting a hold of alcohol wherever I could, usually my parents' liquor cabinet. My mom drank that cheap, nasty wine in a box, and I've mixed that with orange juice and a big thing, and I would drink like just pounding liquor, and I never just had like a little sip of something. It was always like as much as I can get in as quickly before anyone finds out, so I can get wasted. It's always how I've drank. I don't ever remember drinking one. If I drank one, it was torture for me because I just needed to really drink to be okay. And so as a result of that, I started paying prices really quickly. Just blackouts in the middle of the day on a school day and get caught by my parents. Getting a little heat that I didn't really want, so I decided I better cool that, so I quit. And this was like around 17, and I remember that that's the first time that I wanted to kill myself. And looking back now, I really believe that that was untreated alcoholism, that I had gone over the line, and when I put alcohol down, which was my solution to how I felt, I wanted to kill myself. And that describes me exactly. Like, every time I've tried to put down alcohol on my own, I want to kill myself. And I want to kill you, and I hate everyone around me, and it's a nightmare. And I tried it more than once, and it never worked for me. I always picked alcohol back up again. And I thought, you know, because I didn't know anything about alcoholism, that alcoholism just meant that I drank too much, and if I wasn't drinking, then everything would be okay. And I just found out over and over and over again that I'm not okay when I'm not drinking if I don't have some kind of solution. And I couldn't put all those pieces together then, but looking back, that's definitely what it was. And so, big shock, I picked up alcohol again, I started drinking again, after I'd not drank for a couple of years. And when I picked it up, I was off to the races again, and I just, I'll fast forward, I drank and I fell down a lot, and I would wake up with unexplained injuries, not knowing how I got home, not knowing what happened to me, with some deep kind of shame that something had happened that shouldn't have happened, and I couldn't tell you that I was afraid that that had happened, because then you wouldn't like me, or you would think I was weird, or whatever. So things were happening that I couldn't explain, and that was happening pretty early on. I was like losing track of things, and then not really wanting to talk about it. And if I did talk about it, I'd make a joke about it that really wasn't funny, so you would laugh, and then we could drink more about it. And that's kind of how that went for a long time. And, I moved from Texas to Atlanta, Atlanta to Philly, Philly to North Carolina, back to Philly. I got in all kinds of relationships, and the motive for my relationships was always, I want to feel better, make me feel good. And I would lure these people in, like, under the guise that I was going to, like, make their life a lot better, you know, and make them almost believe that I was, like, their higher power, that I was some kind of really great person. And then as soon as I got hooked in, I'd turn on them and just suck them dry. And as a result of that, I was emotionally and mentally cruel to people. Sometimes I was physically abusive. Whatever I had to do to get my way, that's what I did. I manipulated the people I was with. I was not like a, you know, I have a hard time rightly relating myself to others because I'm an alcoholic, and I showed that in every relationship I was ever in. And I'm not proud of that, but what's cool now is I'm actually in a relationship, and I don't act like a monster because I have a set of principles that I can live by and apply in every area of my life. And it's showing me that I'm not a monster. I thought I was a monster because I really acted like a monster for so long. So that's kind of neat. And I tried jobs. I had like, you know, a kind of a, when piercing became the big thing, I got a job as a piercer, and I, you know, started making a lot of money, and that went right to my head, and I had a big ego about it, but I would act all spiritual because it seemed like, you know, if I acted real spiritual, you would like me and you would think I was more authentic with what I was doing. And I was full of it. I was really full of it, and I was arrogant and, you know, terrified on the inside. And I did whatever I had to do to get people to like me, and I made a lot of money, and I don't have anything to show for it because I spent all the money drinking and buying my friends so that people would like me. And then I stopped doing that as a job. Now I'm a cook, and you know, it just, money didn't help me, living places, relationship, nothing on the outside that I tried to put inside ever helped me. It never made me feel whole. I never felt happy. There would be times where maybe things wouldn't be that bad, but it would always inevitably return to that point where I just felt empty inside, you know, and because I would get what I thought was enough of whatever it was, and then instantly it would turn into not enough, and then I would need to get more. It was horrible. You know what I'm talking about, because you've all been there in one way or the other. So I did that, and, you know, what did I say? I fell down a lot. I said that already, right? Just a little illustration. When I was 22, as a direct result of my drinking, I climbed a big, tall fence, like probably a 10-foot fence, in the middle of the night, drunk, because I was going to make a phone call I shouldn't have been making, and I got to the top of the fence, and I slipped, and I fell on my neck with my legs over my head on the concrete, and I was alone, and I was like, oh, great, you know, I'm 22, and now I'm paralyzed, and I just remember laying there being like, oh, this is really bad, I'm really screwed, what am I going to do, and I had a choice. I could lay there until the morning when somebody left the apartment complex, like drove out the gates. I lived in a gated community or whatever. Or I could get up and risk being paralyzed for the rest of my life. So I got up and I risked being paralyzed. And somehow I'm not paralyzed. I really don't know how that didn't happen. Well, I kind of have a clue about it. Probably didn't happen, but it didn't happen. And what I did was I lied and said, I left out that I had been drinking, and I got everyone to feel sorry for me about how injured I was and how terrible it had been that I'd fallen off the fence, and then I went right back to drinking. So it just shows, I was 22 when that happened, and I didn't come into AA until I was 34, so no physical injury, no amount of like physical discomfort or anything like that is enough to make me stop. Like, it didn't make me stop. And it didn't make me wake up and realize that I had a problem. It just made me drink more. So so anyway, finally after moving around a lot, being really miserable and ruining a lot of relationships and burning a lot of bridges and making a lot of people angry and driving a lot of people away and all that stuff that we do, I had moved back to Philadelphia from North Carolina. Because I'd moved down to North Carolina because I thought if I got in a band and wrote a lot of music and made a demo, then I would be happy, you know. And I went down there, and of course I talked it up so everyone would think I was cool. And I went down there, and I wanted to kill myself, and it was really bad. So I upped the drinking to try to make myself feel better, and so it wasn't working. The more I drank, the worse I felt. And finally, I moved back to Philly to get in a relationship because I was sure that would fix it. Got back to Philly, got in a relationship, and guess what? That didn't fix it. It actually was like, it got really, really bad. And I don't know if you've ever been in a relationship where, like, you're screaming and fighting every 5 seconds. If you go an hour without screaming and fighting, you have a good relationship. And then, like, you're screaming and fighting, but you just practically hate the person, but you can't see yourself living without them. That was the kind of relationship I was in, and it was a nightmare for both parties involved. And I was working in a bar as a cook. It was great to work in a bar as a cook. I got in the restaurant business because I could drink exactly the way I wanted to. Everyone around me was drinking the way that I did, so I fit right in. It wasn't a big deal. And, you know, the things that were happening to me, we would laugh about them over drinks because they were happening to everybody else, too. So I figured, well, this isn't that bad. You know, I don't drink any worse than anyone around me, so I must not have a problem. But I was just falling apart, and it was just... It was getting worse and worse and worse, and I was pretty sure at this point in the back of my mind that I was an alcoholic. I don't know if you've drank knowing that you're an alcoholic and then not been able to stop. Probably everybody here has done that. It feels horrible, and that's how I felt, horrible. And I tried to squeeze a little more attention out of the girlfriend and get a little more over here and make a little more money and all that stuff, and none of it's working. And finally, one day, not anything any different than any other thing that I had ever really experienced, I just couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't live with the lying and the just everything I was doing. I couldn't stand the sight of myself. I was like drinking to get myself into a blackout, and right as I was about to black out, I would ride my bike all the way across town where I lived, and then, you know, most of the time lose track of time and wake up and not know how I got home. And, you know, I was just doing that every single day. And I'd wake up in the middle of the night having anxiety and terror and shame, guilt and fear and all that stuff. And it would just, I would have to drink more to go back to bed. And then it just, you know what it's like. It was terrifying, and it was a nightmare. And I had this night where I blacked out, and I broke my glasses, and I had a black eye that I couldn't explain, and I didn't know how I'd gotten home, and I was pretty sure something had happened to me that I couldn't tell you about. Like, I guess I could be specific. I kept thinking I had been raped and didn't know, you know. And then you pile that on top of the gender stuff, and then I really can't tell you, because then how am I going to explain that to you? So that's the kind of terror I was living with, just to be specific and stop dancing around it, and it really sucked. And I would have to drink to cover it up because it just scared me. And finally, I just couldn't take that anymore. So I remember saying a prayer. I don't really remember what it was, but I knew that, like, if I didn't stop doing what I was doing, then it wasn't going to go anywhere but worse than what it was. And shortly after that, I was actually able to put down alcohol. And I didn't stop. I didn't get sober at that point. But I made a little bargain with God that if I didn't feel okay in a month on my own, I would go to an AA meeting. And I ended up going to an AA meeting. Of course, I went to a special interest group because I thought I needed special AA, because none of you would be able to relate to me because I was really different and unique. And I think it's really funny. I have to, like, throw the gender thing in here for another second, because I thought that really made me different. And what I found out after reading Pass It On, if any of you read Pass It On, when they talk about the history of the third tradition, and I may be telling it wrong, but this is what I remember of it. It was in the 40s, and this big, like, 6'4" transvestite, African-American transvestite, walked into the clubhouse in New York, and this person was a junkie and a drunk, and they were, you know, imagine in the 40s, you know, it's like, that was probably like, oh my God, what is going on, you know, and everybody freaked out, they didn't know what to do, and somebody called Bill, and they were like, oh my God, this is 6 foot tall, you know, like, you know, and Bill was like, wait a minute, slow down, is the person a drunk? And they were like, yeah. Is the person asking for help? Yes. Help that person. So it's like, you know, that was going on in the 40s. I came into AA in 2005. Like, it had already been invented. I didn't even invent that, you know? And, like, and I used it to just, you know, separate myself and, like, you know. Anyway, so I went to a special interest group. Good thing that happened there is the person there gave me my first big book. And he said, read, you know, maybe read some stories in the back and see if you can relate to what these people are talking about. And then come back next week and, you know, we can talk about it or whatever. So I went home and I opened the book up and I read more about alcoholism. I didn't read any of the stories in the back. I just opened it up to more about alcoholism. And when I got to that part where it's the, you know, it's the, what is it, the obsession of every abnormal drinker to someday control and enjoy his drinking, you know, drink like a normal person. When I saw that, I knew I was an alcoholic. Like, I just knew it, just like that thing. I'm an alcoholic. I know it. There's no more playing games with myself about am I or am I not. And I'd like to say that I got sober right then, too, but I didn't. I kept, like, kind of going around AA, and I'd go to a meeting a week, and I'd go to the meetings that I thought I fit into, and I wasn't telling anyone what was really going on with me. I wasn't asking anyone for help. I wasn't talking about how terrified I was and how I didn't know the answers. I wasn't saying any of that. I was just showing up, and when I would share, I would try to entertain people, you know, and show them how well I was doing, and, you know, I'm sure they didn't buy it for a minute, but I guess I was still buying it a little bit, because I kept doing that for a while, and meanwhile, the things I was doing is my home life had gotten more violent. I had become more of a monster and more, like, emotionally unstable. Like, I would just call out of work 5 minutes before I was supposed to be there and take a personal day and think that was fine. You know, and I just couldn't show up for anything, and I was having a really hard time relating myself to anybody else. And I was also using other substances to control my cravings and not asking anyone what they thought of that. And running around telling everyone I was 5.5 months sober, because I was nuts, and I thought I really was, because I wasn't drinking. And so finally, like, after a while, that got really old. And the one thing that was happening, I have to say, throughout this, is I was praying. Because I believe, even though, like, what I talked about, my grandparents thinking God didn't love me and all that stuff, the whole time I was drinking and just kind of going about my life, I was looking for some kind of spiritual path that made sense. So, like, I would dibble and dabble. I would look at Hinduism, and I'd look at Buddhism, and I'd look over here at this, and took over here at that. But it's really hard to, like, practice yoga when you have a hangover. And it's really hard to, like, I just could never get it together. I could never, I've always had a problem with consistency. It's like I would do a little bit of something for a minute, and then I'd be like, this isn't working. And then I'd go do whatever I wanted. And so, you know, but I was open to some kind of spirit of the universe. So I was praying to this spirit of the universe and just saying, show me this, or do, you know, like, take me where I need to go, or whatever, a little, what someone referred to early on for me, and it helped me, it was just little breath prayers. Like, if you can't handle a big, long prayer, just whatever you can fit into a breath, like, show me the way, or, you know, give me the answer, or show me the light, or whatever that you can fit into a breath. And so I would do that, and looking back, every time I did that, I was led to the next, whatever was next. And I didn't see it then because I was just terrified. And, you know, I would spend a lot of time on the couch with my dog in front of the TV until it was time to go to a meeting. And it was embarrassing for me because I always thought I was so outgoing, you know. And I would put that out there for you and make you think I was really outgoing, but inside I was, like, falling apart, and I was anxious and terrified all the time. And when I put down alcohol, it got worse. And so anyway, eventually what I did is I found myself, it's like everyone I didn't like when I first came into AA, they ended up being the people that helped me. And I'm sure everyone here has had an experience like that. There was this guy, I couldn't stand this guy. I thought he was such a jerk. And it's because he was funny, and he was funnier than me. And it bothered me, and I'd just be like, I can't stand that guy. You know, and I would never admit that he was funnier than me. He's still funnier than me, and now he's a good friend of mine. But I just didn't want anything to do with this guy. And then one day after a meeting, I found myself saying to him, what are you doing after the meeting? He's like, well, I'm walking home. And I was standing there like, all like, and he went, do you want to walk with me? And I was like, okay. Yeah. So I followed him home, and I told him the whole truth about myself. I told him everything about myself. And I mean, everything. I just poured out my heart and soul to this guy I didn't even like. And I told him I was scared. I told him that I had been smoking non-conference approved substances. And I actually said, after I told him that, I said, what do you think about that? Wow, you know? So I must have been praying. Something must have been happening, because he said, well, and he was really cool, you know? He didn't point his finger at me and lecture me and tell me I was wrong. He just said, you know, if you're willing to do that now, say you stay sober for 10 years down the road and you're still doing that, what would you be willing to do 10 years from now? You know, like, why don't you just, maybe you could just push the reset button, stop doing that, just stop doing everything, and give this other thing a try and see what happens. So I said, oh, okay. So I did that, and the next thing I did was I prayed for whatever was out there to put someone in my path that could help me, that would take me through the steps, because all of a sudden now I'm, like, all aware of the steps, you know, and I'm thinking, wow, maybe that could help me. And very soon after that, I met someone. And the way that I met him was, he came right up to me after a meeting, after I'd shared that I felt like drinking. And he said, hi, I'm Stan. I've experienced the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you like to do that? And I was like, yeah. He was like, well, are you miserable? Do you feel like dying? You said you wanted to drink. I said, yeah, I'm miserable and I want to die. He was like, okay, well, give me a call. I was like, all right. Well, I went home. Of course, I didn't call him. But the next day, I went to a meeting that I was at all the time that I'd never seen him at, and I saw him again. So I figured, well, I said that prayer, and then this happened. It happened twice, so maybe I'll call this guy. So I did. And he was the first person who took me through the steps. And he actually took me up to the ninth step and then made a referral to someone else. He became a little less available, and I switched sponsors right at that point. And I had that sponsor for the first probably year and a half that I was sober. And I guess, you know, my experience was that I experienced the steps quickly. I'm really grateful that I did, because for me, you know, when I didn't have alcohol and I didn't have a solution, like I said, I wanted to kill myself and I wanted to kill you, and I couldn't even leave the house, and I just was like, I was a mess. So for me, it made sense to, you know, do something different. And that's how it was put to me. Like, maybe it won't work for me, for you. Maybe you'll be the only person it doesn't work for, but you can try it. and then see what happens. So that's what I did. I just went along for the ride, and I didn't ask a lot of questions. I just did whatever he told me to do, you know. And as a result, at 60 days sober, I was at home in Texas making amends, starting to clean up the wreckage of my past, and starting to try to do things differently. And then, you know, my new sponsor came into my life, and, you know, she was really, really helpful. Like, just helped me to get a foundation in AA, to get a, you know, I was too scared to get a home group. I was terrified. Like, I thought, if I, well, I didn't want to commit to anything, you know, and it took me a while to commit to a home group. And then, you know, at four and a half months sober, she looked me right in the eye and she said, "Why aren't you helping anyone?" I was like, well, I can't. I don't think I, She was like, "Okay, you got to help someone." And I was like, "But I don't think I'm ready." And then within 10 minutes, she had this person, this brand new person that had like 5 days maybe, and just spun her around and went, "This is your sponsee," you know, and made me sponsor this person. And she did a lot of things for me that were really amazing. I've been blessed with the gift of excellent sponsorship since I walked in. Somehow I think the combination of just praying for, you know, whatever needed to happen to just happen, and then somehow I was given the willingness to do that when it shows up, and that's always been the case. And I really don't know how. I don't understand how. So I try not to think about how or why. I just try to do what I've been taught to do in AA, and that's been working really well for me. So I don't see any reason to stop doing it. You know, and I guess just some things that have happened for me. I'm not going to go individually through every step, or I'm just going to like kind of maybe touch on a few things that I think are important in my experience, like since I've got sober. You know, just it took me about a year and a half to be willing to make amends with my dad, because my dad, when I was 9, when my parents split up, my dad had an affair. And I didn't know about it. I didn't find out about it until I was 18. But as soon as I found out, I decided I hated him and he had ruined my life. And I just went out of my way to not really, you know, try to, you know, be warm and inviting. I mean, you know, I guess I had somewhat of a relationship with my dad, but I really, deep down inside, I blamed him for everything. So it probably wasn't much of a relationship from his end. I don't know. I never really got the chance to ask him. He was a real talkative guy, so he probably, I don't know if he would have even told me, but it took me a while to be willing. And I remember I tried to make amends with him over an email, and I told my sponsor, like, you know, when you do something and then you call your sponsor and you don't ask what they think of it, you just say, "Oh, I did blah blah blah," and then you brag like you did something awesome and you want them to pat you on the back. Well, that's what I did. I was like, "Oh, well, you know, I sent my dad an email and I made amends." And she's like, "Why did you do that?" She's like, "Well, because, you know, I owed him an amends." And she's like, "Well, why wouldn't you do it face to face?" I was like, "Well, you know, my dad's, you know, not a very emotional man, and I just thought, you know, it would make him really uncomfortable." And she's like, "Okay, well, are you willing to do that over again? Because, you know, you really need to do this stuff face-to-face." So I was like, "All right, I guess I'm willing, you know, whatever." Thinking, I'd probably never do that, you know. And one day I was in Texas. It was, like I said, I was about a year sober, maybe a little more than that. And I would go to my dad's, and I would just stay one night there. And, like, I mean, they had to beg me to go over there. And I would stay one night, and I'd feel like I'd done them all a favor, and then I would leave and go back to my mom's where I wanted to be, you know. And, you know, I did that. That's what I did for a really long time. I didn't see any problem with it. And I did that, and I left his house. And I was getting on a plane the next day, so that was the last time I was going to see them, right? And I went to a meeting, and as I was sitting in the meeting, I couldn't concentrate on a single thing anyone was saying. I was being eaten alive with the fact that I had not made that amend that I knew that I was supposed to do it. And I left the meeting after it was over, and I drove back to my dad's house. And I was praying the whole way there, and I was terrified, and I was freaking out. I didn't want to do it, but I knew I had to. And I couldn't get a hold of my sponsor, so I was like, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God." And I just went in there, and I sat my dad and my stepmom down, and I did what I've been taught to do in AA, and I made amends to them verbally. And, you know, they were really cool about it, and it was fine. And, you know, probably you all have made amends to your families, and a lot of times family members are really cool about it. "Oh, just keep doing what you're doing, it's no big deal," whatever. Well, about 3 months later, I got a call from my dad, and he told me that he had cancer. He had been diagnosed with cancer. Again, this is the second time that he had it. And now, after I made that verbal amends, I did another thing that I was taught in AA, which is don't just say that, you know, you're going to set it right. Actually set it right with your behavior. Change. And if you're not going to change, don't say anything. Just leave that person alone. And I'm glad that that was taught to me, because I started to change my behavior and or become willing to change it, and it just changed. And, you know, I would call my dad and talk to him. I used to never call him. I'd be like, oh, well, the phone works both ways. Why don't you call me? You know, I'd be thinking that, and I wouldn't call him. And, you know, just stubborn and just a jerk, you know. And I realized after I made amends with him that for many, many years he had been available to have a relationship with me. I was telling myself, he's never there for me, and he doesn't want to, blah, 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 all that crap. And he had been showing up for quite some time, ready to have a relationship with me, and I was, like, doing whatever I was doing. I wasn't available to have one with him. So making that amends allowed me to be available, and I had started to call him on a regular basis and see how he was doing and reach out to his wife, who I also thought had ruined my life, because my dad married the woman that he had an affair with. And, you know, I was like, so I had all these stories I told myself about that, and I started to try to do that differently. So when my dad told me that he had cancer, I was already having a relationship with him. So I didn't have to scurry around trying to clean a bunch of stuff up so I could try to have a relationship with him. I was just available to start doing that. And my dad and I were like, I cleaned it up. So when my dad died last year in June, there was no unfinished business between us, and he was able to go on to wherever he's gone on to and do the next thing without having to feel that he had in any way done me any harm or any kind of disservice. And that's amazing, because I could never see it that way before. All I could think of is my dad's dead and poor me and this is horrible. And I was able to see that, you know, my stepmother lost the love of her life, my sister lost her father. You know, it's like a lot of people lost out, you know, and I was able to show up for my dad's funeral and stand up and speak for him on his behalf. I sounded like a dolphin when I was up there, because I was so emotional. I was like, hey! And it was horrible, but I did it. I showed up because I was sober, and I cleaned that up, so I was able to walk in there with my head held high and speak on my father's behalf, and it was, like, amazing, you know, and I got through the first year of my dad being gone as a sober person, and I'm here to tell you that, like, just because, you know, I've experienced the steps and I continue to practice the principles and all that, grief still really sucks. When it sucks, it really sucks. So I don't want to paint a picture that, like, everything's great and I'm happy, joyous, and free all the time, you know. I am happy, joyous, and free, and when I feel pain and when I'm grieving a loss, I hurt like any other human being, and so when it hurts, I talk to the people that are close to me, and I show up in AA, and I do the things that I'm supposed to be doing, you know, and when I do that, I'm okay. It still hurts, but I'm okay, and that's amazing, because when I was drinking, I had this little pet toad about this big, and he died, and I drank a whole bottle of whiskey and went to work like that, over a toad. And that's how any little thing that hurt me, I had to get drunk about it and, like, freak out, make a big drama, and everyone should feel sorry for me. And, like, I'm not the only person in the world that's ever lost their father, you know? And I have definitely already been able, like, pretty much the day my dad died, I was already able to start helping people with that experience. So it's amazing. Like, I no longer feel like my life is happening to me, and you're all out to get me, and everyone's picking on me all the time, and God's up there laughing at me because this is a big joke. I don't feel like that anymore. And I feel like, you know, I guess what's so great for me, and the thing that, like, you know, all this life beyond my wildest dreams kind of stuff, is just that I can show up and be a part of the human race. Like, I never even wanted to be a part of the human race. I was convinced that I was something different, like some kind of, I don't know, alien or different special person, or I don't really know what I thought I was, but I wasn't interested in showing up for for everything that life has to offer, even the painful, messy, difficult things. And this program's given me the ability to do that. And still, you know, I mean, I can hold my head up and walk with dignity no matter what's going on in my life. And I never could walk with dignity anywhere because I was too ashamed of the things I was doing or embarrassed about who I thought you thought I was. You know, I was just constantly trapped inside of myself and suffering from the delusion of separateness. And I don't live like that anymore. And the people around me don't have to live the way that they had to live when I was like that. You know, I can, like I'm in my mom's life today, and I'm able to be her child and, you know, like let her be my mom. And, you know, my sister and I have a great relationship, and I have these two little nieces that are really awesome, and I get to be in their life, and, you know, I'm in a band with a bunch of sober people, and we get to play shows and, you know, like make music and be sober. I just can't even get over that. I thought like I would have to drink and do stuff because that's what musicians do, and I can make music and not, you know, I can let, I don't know, it just comes from a different place now. The motive is different. I'm not up there so that you'll love me. I'm up there so maybe I could share something with other people. And I guess like whether it's music or anything else I'm doing, I'm able to look at it that way now. What can I bring to the experience, and how can I, you know, how can I like help? How can I help other people? But how can I like, you know, enhance other people's lives and be like a positive? You know, I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to take whatever I could and go home. You know what I mean? And that's it. Just blows me away that I can do that. And another amends that I made is I had this employer that kept feeling sorry for me and hiring me back, even though I screwed her over and over and over again. And actually, I only worked there twice, so I'm making it sound really dramatic. But I worked there like over and over and over again. No, it was twice. Did I say I was a liar? I like to exaggerate. I've always been a big exaggerator. So. But now I can actually say I just exaggerated instead of like backing it up with more lies and like making you think I'm awesome or I'm the worst person in the world. But anyway, she had hired me back. I'd been a horrible employee. She fired me because I deserved it. And then she hired me back later on, and I did the same thing again, and she fired me again because I deserved it. And one day, it was one of those amends I thought I would never make. I didn't think I could go look her in the eye. So I sort of like I don't even think I wrote it on my 8-step list, to be perfectly honest. And one day I was walking down the street, and I happened to walk by that restaurant that I worked at, and I just peeked over in the garden, and she was standing right there, and I was like, oh. She's like, oh, hi, Cooper. I was like, hi. And then all of a sudden, I found myself making amends because I couldn't say anything other than look, you know, and I laid it out there the way I'd been taught. And she looked at me. She'd been around people that had been in AA, and she just looked at me and she went, I've never been anyone's amends before. You know, and I was like, yeah, well, you know. So I did that verbally, right? And then right after that, a dear friend of ours who had also worked at the restaurant killed himself. And I was able, because I cleaned up that wreckage between she and I, to walk into the restaurant with my head held up high and see how I could help everyone there. And I was able to be a part of that experience with those people. And then shortly after that, I had to quit the job that I had because I created a lot of wreckage there as well, but I had cleaned that up. And I had pretty much done all I could do there, and it was time to move on. But perfect alcoholic, I was keeping one claw in there and not letting it go. Like, oh, I'm scared I'm not going to get another job. Oh, my God, what if I'm not taken care of? You know, I'm just freaking out in general. And staying there, it was just getting worse and worse and worse because I wouldn't let go of it. So my sponsor at the time directed me to let go of it and trust God. So I did. I let it go, and I trusted God. And I didn't have a job for 2 months. I had enough money to pay my rent, buy a little dog food, you know, that kind of stuff. But like, and it got down to like what my sponsor then called the 11th hour. And I still didn't have a job, and I'd gone to my landlord and said, I don't have a job, and I don't know if I can pay the rent, as I've been directed to. And he was like this scary kind of, I thought, mean guy. And he just looked at me and said, look, You're a great tenant. You pay the rent on time. I've never had a problem from you. I would rather have you living in the apartment, not paying the rent, than someone I can't trust paying the rent and living here. So I know you're going to get another job, so you just live here and you pay me when you can pay me. And don't worry about it otherwise. I was like, what? This is amazing. And then it got down to the line. I had $12 in my bank account. I was really freaking out. And I was getting to where I was like, you better get me a job. Because I was talking to God. I was just like, you better work God in the job. I've been patient. I've been humble. I've done everything you asked. And I just want to start. You know, I was freaking out. And the Serenity Prayer was like, God, God, and so I had $12 in my bank account. I called my sponsor and I'm like, dude, I had $12 in my bank account. It's like, do you think God loves you less when you have $12 in your bank account than God loves you when you have thousands of dollars in your bank account? I was like, hadn't thought about that. So it got down to the wire, right? And then one day, out of the blue, I get this phone call from the general manager of that restaurant that I worked at where I screwed them over twice and they fired me twice. She said, look, it's kind of a weird question, but we're in a bind and we need someone to work one day tomorrow. Just get us through the shift. You don't even have to be good at it. Just get us through it and then, you know, we didn't get the shift covered. There's nobody else that can do it. Can you do it? I was like, sure, I'll do it. Because that's what I was taught to do in AA. You know, I couldn't just, like, say pretty words. When someone asked me to do something, I had to be there to do it because I needed to show through my actions that I'm a different person. So I got off the phone, and then I was like, oh, God, what did I just do? Because it's a really high-volume, difficult, I mean, it's a very high-pressure job, and it's constant movement. We're never sitting down. We're always moving and going. And the station they wanted me to work was the hardest one. And I was just like, I don't even know if I have the skills to do this. Like, I was just like, oh, God, what am I going to do? So I was like, all right, look, you got to go to work with me tomorrow. You know, I'm like bargaining with God. As if God's not going to go. God was like, oh, I don't go to God. I don't do that. You know, I'm going to stay at home. You just go on without me. You can handle it. You'll be a fine kid. Like, I'm going, please, you got to go to work with me. You got to do my job because I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm freaking out. So I go to work and I took God with me, and God did my job, and like God did a really high number that day, like for the restaurant, and God really impressed my old employer, and she called me back the next day. She had been out of town. She said, "Look, do you want to come back to work here?" And I was like, "Sure." And then she proceeded. I had done a job, like a job ideal worksheet. My sponsor suggested that I write down, you know, what I had to offer a job, what they would have to offer me, and what that ideal thing looked like. So I did that. And then she proceeded without me prompting to offer me every single thing that was on that list. And I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Sure. When can I start? You know? And I was able to say to her, look, I can't work more than this amount of hours per week because when I work too much, I get burnt out and I'll end up screwing you over. I was able to be honest about what I could actually bring and just tell her what every limitation I might have and just be honest. And she was like, that's no problem. Sure, we'll do whatever we can. We'd love to have you back. And 2 years later, I'm still working there. And what's beautiful about that is that when I show up at that job, my motive for being at that job is to clean up the wreckage of my past, is to be that person that I was unable to be when I was drinking. And it's not to make money. It's not to make people like me. It's none of that stuff. I need to be there to show through my actions that I'm a different person today. And then what I get out of that is I also get paid. You know, and I get all that other stuff. And it's just been my experience that when my motive is correct, all that other stuff falls into place. And I have to say that I still need a sponsor. I definitely have to like be in like constant contact with a higher power because on my own I'm not able to do any of those things. And I know because, you know, I'll just say this and then I'll be done. But like that part in the big book where it talks about how we had moral and philosophical, convictions galore and we would have liked to have lived up to them, whatever. You know what I mean. And I really relate to that. It's like beyond my drinking. I always wanted to be a good person. I always wanted to be like, you know, help people and be a part of things and like really, you know, I always had that desire deep down inside me, but on my own, with my own power, I'm unable to do that. And today, because I got in here and I finally admitted that I didn't know what I was doing, and I got willing to follow some direction, and I stayed pretty willing to do that, I can do that now. I can show up for my life. You know, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, I can show up for it. And it just blows me away. I mean, it's good stuff. I tried everything, and then I tried this, and it worked. So I'm going to keep coming back. Thanks.